The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchen.
And me, Lachlan Boone.
If this is your first time listening to the podcast, this is a conversation that we have with writers largely, but other kind of creative folk about their craft, approach and technique, often interested in people ploughing a different furrow to the usual.
Yeah, and I think it's fair to say that this month's guest, Bill Drummond, has ploughed several different furrows across the span of his career. He's probably best known as half of the art pop duo KLF, as well as for burning £1 million in cash. But having famously quit the music industry in the early 90s, he subsequently worked on a range of art events / collaborations / performances, as well as writing books and plays. And it was really fascinating speaking to Bill just about the range of creative projects and processes he's involved with and how he approaches those.
Yeah, I mean, to both of us, Bill's a kind of household name, but I think it's worth, if you're not familiar with the KLF and the work he did on the music side of things, go and read up about it. There's a great documentary out at the moment. I think some of the tunes are on streaming and things like that, but that's kind of, because it's so well known, maybe a less interesting field for us to explore. So we really spoke to Bill about his writing and his route to writing.
Yeah, I think it was clear speaking to Bill how much of a constant writing has been throughout his career across very different disciplines.
And it was just really interesting to talk to him about his path to where he got to and what he's doing now as well, because he's doing a lot of very collaborative stuff. Some of that centered around the Curfew Tower, which he talks about, which is the kind of artist residence place that he has in the north of Ireland. That had an interesting beginning, which we talk about a bit. And we talked about his memoir that he's been working on and how he got other people to contribute material to that. We have a bit of a discussion about whose work that then ends up being, but
yeah, we got into some quite interesting questions about authorship. In the memoir that we discuss, it's been written by 70 different authors who all contributed a 1,000-word chapter, and it's then been read by Bill. So where the authorship lies is obviously quite a good question.
The sort of play elements of it, as in theatrical plays, they've just started coming out, I think, so you can go and catch up with them as well. All the rest of it should be available, but as he discusses, it may be disappearing over time. And he's just got a really interesting approach to things. You know, he's obviously a guy who's really not interested in just doing the obvious memoir.
No, I think in speaking with Bill, it was obvious that he's not interested in doing the obvious in any medium, whether that's conceptual art, music, or writing. But without any further ado, we give you Bill Drummond.
We often begin by asking people about when they started writing, so we focus on that. And I appreciate that, as well as writing, you've been involved in a lot of different things. But I think maybe the journey towards this point is interesting in that I wanted to ask about when you were younger and you started sort of doing creative practice, whatever you want that to mean. What was your first sort of outlet?
I ended up going to art school, but even that was an accident. I got asked to leave the sixth form. The careers advice officer in the town that we were living in, Corby, which is a one-industry town, steel, was trying to get me to go for an apprenticeship at the steelworks, which I declined to do. And then, as I said, I got asked to leave school. My mother went and spent money on a professional careers advice officer down in London. And they spent a whole day doing tests with me and interviewing me. But the first two questions were, what are you interested in? And this is me as a 16-year-old. I said, music. And they said, what do you think you're good at? And I said, making things. So they said, well, you should become... And then they sent the invoice and a whole thing to my mother saying I should become a musical instrument maker. So I thought, okay, as in making violins. And so my mother contacted them and said, well, how do you do this? She says, well, first he's got to train to be a cabinet maker. I said, okay, so where do you train to be a cabinet maker? And back then, the kind of upmarket carpentry trade was based in High Wycombe, okay? So I approached the whatever there and says, well, you've got to go and learn to draw first. You've got to go do a foundation course in art school. So I did some drawings, got into my local art school, which was Northampton, and did a two-year foundation, which is then, in those days, was the equivalent of doing sixth form, and got into painting and did this, and then went to Liverpool to do a three-year course in fine art in painting. And then things happened there. Actually, I walked into a bookshop and picked up a book, and I'd never really read books. You know, I hated doing English at school. I failed English language and English literature, O-level, GCSE. But then at the age of 19 or whatever I was, completely fell in love with reading. And also, there was something about art school that happened. I just felt everybody there was in a bubble. And when I was reading these books, it was like out there in the world. Now, it was very male, very, you know, male, white male protagonist type books that I was reading. And so I quit art school at the age of 20 to become a writer. I started writing then. And then obviously things got in the way and other things happened. And
I guess a pretty banal question, but I'm interested in whether even 3 years later, when you were at art school, were you still thinking, I'm going to end up making violins here?
Oh, no, no, no. Within a week of being at art school, you know, it was like, oh, wow, okay, you know, this is something else. I hadn't done art at GCSE, just hadn't even crossed my mind. It didn't exist in my school.
Did writing, when would your 16-year-old self put writing under the umbrella of making things? Was that something you made, or was that something different that you, art was making things and writing was something else?
No, you said 16. It was 19 by the time I got into right. No, it was actually, I think it was all the same. I rejected what was going on in art school at the time. I mean, stuff had happened to me that encouraged me to reject it and just go down this other avenue. And what I was reading, I had no context for where it came from. So something like Henry Miller. I didn't know of Henry Miller, so I'd be reading Henry Miller. You know, he was acceptable to read back then. He's maybe not acceptable to read now. But, you know, I had no idea what decade he was writing in or... Mm. Yeah, not nothing, and or even something like Jack Kerouac. Nobody said, "Oh, he's one of the Beats." No idea. You know, I didn't know that this character in this book was this actual poet over here called Allen Ginsberg. Nothing. I just picked up a book, read the back of it, thought, "Okay, I'll try this. Read it. Okay, I like this. I'll get another one of his, and then it could be." What's the Norwegian guy who then became a bit dodgy because... Yeah. You know, picked up... Oh, yeah. So it was, as I said, it was all that very blokey, you know, stuff that got me out there.
And were you in tandem sort of starting to write? Were you sort of reading and then putting the book down and writing 10 pages? Or was the writing a slower process?
I started writing... pretty much straight away. I mean, I wasn't thinking of, okay, I write a book and then I find a publisher that wasn't even crossing my mind. It was just the process of writing that pulled me in. But it was also the process of going out there into the world and doing different things. I think I thought I had to experience the world first to go out and do things. So I worked in a mental hospital for 6 months. And I think that was a straight from reading, can't remember, got turned into a film.
Ken Kesey.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And then I signed up as an apprentice on a trawler out of Aberdeen and only did a couple. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to stay that, but I felt I needed to...
Experience things,
go out there. And, you know, I read... What's his face from... I'm sorry, I'm so bad with names, all right? You know, he's obviously one of the bigs of the 20th century. He goes out to join the Spanish Revolution. And... Not Ernest Hemingway, an English guy, not George Orwell, but, you know, that in the 30s, he's from Shropshire lad, or yeah.
Laurie Lee or something.
Yeah, I think it's Laurie Lee, okay? And I thought, okay, I've got to go and join a revolution, or got to go and... It was just kicking off in Portugal, and so I hitchhiked to Portugal, you know, not being able to speak any language, not got there... I was in a sleeping bag lying in a field the first night in Portugal, and I heard all these gunfire going off, and I thought, what the hell am I doing here? You know what? And I wake up next morning, go into this village and find out the revolution had happened. It was historically called the Carnation Revolution, without a shot being fired. So the shots I heard were celebrations of this revolution happening without a shot being fired.
It's hard to tell with gunfire, I would imagine.
Yeah. No, it was real gunfire.
Yeah, but you can't tell if it's celebratory or the start of a civil war.
And of course, now I think, well, me doing that is exactly the same as some 19-year-old, 20-year-old lad joining ISIS. You know, it's the same...
Yeah, to be at the centre of what's happening.
Yeah.
And were you sort of taking notes through the life as you were experiencing these different things? Did you have any kind of process to, recording it in words?
Yeah, I did write it all. I mean, I can't say all of it, and I didn't keep it. I don't have any record of these things at all, but it was ongoing. As I keep saying, this is me being defensive, none of it was really about relationships. You know, there was no arc of a story. There was no plot line. It was just me puking up words onto a page, exploring. There was ideas. That's what... And it was more about challenging myself. I don't mean just physically, but mentally challenging myself.
And were you comfortable with that at the time, that you weren't necessarily... working towards an end goal? It was, you were going through the practice and kind of just getting used to, sort of getting those muscles built up, or, you know, whatever metaphor might.
Oh, I didn't even think of it. The books that I was into didn't seem to be written to be a novel with a beginning, middle, and end, you know, with something happens in the first 10 pages that you've got to see how that's going to resolve itself. They were just kind of open-ended. Mm-hmm. I mean, now, you know, we can look at Henry Miller and thinking, what the sod's he on about? You know, it's just some bloke up his own arse. But, you know, to me as a 20-year-old, this was going out there and exploring the world and exploring ideas and being in uncomfortable places. Mm-hmm. That was always an attraction, being in uncomfortable situations in uncomfortable places.
Did you find it easy? Did the words sort of flow onto the page, or did you find it a slog that you felt, like, this is important in some way? I want to get this done. I'm in this uncomfortable position, and I want to get some words on the page, but it's difficult. Or was it a case of a stack of 20 pages have just appeared by magic almost?
At times I have issues. I have to stop myself. Thus, I just write nonstop. There are other times where I have to say, okay, you've got to do X many words before you can have a tea break or a coffee break, you know, to get... It's basically the morning, you know. By the afternoon, my head's kind of burnt out. And I keep thinking, OK, I've done it now. That's it. I never have to write another word. And then I might get through a couple of days and I'm writing again. Yeah. Always morning, yeah. Yeah, very much so. You know, in my ideal world, I'm in bed by 9 o'clock every night, sort of.
I guess then you had a natural sort of... period that you'd be writing to kind of get up and write straight away, or
there are structures in place because of family life, you know, getting kids to school or before picking kids up from school or other things like that, where it defines, okay, I've got to get it done between here and here. So there are those things, but when there are not those things, you know, in those brief periods in my life where I don't have the family situation, I'd be up at five.
Would you have a draft? Do you take any notes, first of all? Is there such a thing as a note, or is everything you write part of the writing, so to speak?
Sometimes, yes, I will have a basic structure. I know what I'm working towards doing. Other times, I'm just writing, and then I go, this is about this. And then I can put all what I've written up till then to one side, and I can see a structure and I kind of start again.
There's not sort of a period where you're solely taking notes and you're waiting to start writing, or... maybe there is.
Because I don't write traditional novels, so there doesn't have to be that, and then you get to the bit at the end where... She kills him, or they run off together, or whatever it is, or they both commit suicide, or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think nearly all the authors we've spoken to on the podcast, they tend to speak to people that don't really follow that sort of plot and arc. I know a lot of, you go to any airport bookshop, that is the standard, but most of the people we speak to kind of splits between people that sort of take notes, and other authors we've spoken to go, no, I don't take any notes. I don't record anything other than the pen hits the paper and it starts, whatever comes out. So I guess I'm just curious if you see note-taking as something that is sort of necessary for the person. Like if you leave here today, would you have a notepad or your phone or something and jot things down for later, or?
Yeah, yes. Well, I'm sending myself texts all the time. So I don't do it on the notebook on my phone. I got in my bag here, I got my notebook and I got my laptop. So, you know, I cannot sit on a bus or the tube without getting those out and starting.
And that might be just three words to remind yourself, or it might be a paragraph.
And to go back, so there's two film things. One's a short film. And so with a film, you have to have far more of a definite arc, or I assume you do, you know, this. And this short film is to be filmed through this spring. So I did write, I knew what the end was. I wrote the whole thing. The film's called Stay. There's only one actor in it, and it's all the words are an internal dialogue between himself and a puppet of Elvis. Did a spoken word version of that last week where I'm doing all the instructions and the actor playing the part does his voice, or he's called the artist. Okay, he's not nothing to do with, he's not me, he's not a version of me at all, but, and the puppet of Elvis and
the actor. So will the actor speak, the actor will be silent, but there'll be a voiceover with the actor's voice at the same time?
You never see him. You have the actor in the film, you know, but you never see his lips move.
Yeah, he's acting what the voice is saying.
Yeah, yes.
Over the top, yeah.
And this is related to the project that you're currently working on as a whole?
Yeah, there's a thing called the Curfew Tower, which is an artist residency, which I sort of run in the north of Ireland. It came from 2 or 3 years ago. I heard that the Elvis Presley estate was selling Graceland, which is Elvis's home, to the highest bidder. So it was either going to be taken apart and go to Saudi Arabia or Tokyo or Beijing, whoever raised the most money. And they take it there because they could earn more money from people going there than to Memphis to do tours. And I thought this was sort of bizarre and so wrong, or something for me just felt... So I decided that I would turn... this artist residency, which is called the Curfew Tower, and I decided I should turn that into Graceland for the ghost of Elvis for 1 year.
Right.
So it's from that then this, which then got turned into a Radio 4 programme that went out earlier this year. But from all that, this idea of this film, this artist... So this year, the artists staying in the tower have all got to write a song for the ghost of Elvis. So this artist, this fictitious artist, is to be the first artist in residence. Right. Or this actor playing the part of...
They're there for a month?
They could, yeah, traditionally they're there for a month, but the way we're doing this, they can just go for a couple of nights. Mm-hmm. And they have to, there's a cassette player, and they have to write a song in the room at the top of the tower.
Right.
For the ghost of Elvis to perform.
So there's quite a kind of collaborative element to that as well, which seems to be something that you're sort of bringing in. So as I understand it, with the spoken word novels,
yep.
You've sort of packaged the time frame of it up, or a year of your life, for example, and then gone out to... You've asked real people to write this.
Okay.
It's difficult to find the distinction within the fiction.
Well, I guess that's the influence of having a sort of art background as well, okay? What you're referring to is a novel called The Life Model. Okay. So the first day I was at art school, when I was 17, the first lesson I had was life drawing. And the art school, the teacher told us, even before the model came in, says, anybody can look, I'm here to teach you to see. So the model comes in, she stands in the middle, she takes off her traditional life model gown. I don't think I'd ever seen a naked woman at that point. You know, I was 16, say. A woman... maybe in our 60s, and we're all sitting around on to draw her, and we're given 10 seconds, piece of charcoal, and you've got to come up with... So it's not about coming up with something that looks stunning or great. You've just got to interpret what you see in front of you. And the tutor's telling us, you're all seeing it from different perspectives. There's not one thing here. So that was a starting point. That shifted something in my head that stayed there, that there's not... I mean, I'm talking in cliches. There's not one truth. This, you know. And then a couple of years ago, two or three years ago now, I was asked to read a memoir. I was asked to read about three different memoirs that were coming out, different publishing houses. And I just felt they all follow the same format, which is whatever, whether it's a musician, a footballer, or Prince Harry, or whoever it is, It is poverty, so the poverty can be emotional poverty or fiscal poverty, struggle, achieving something, and what's achieved then starts sliding away and then coming to terms with life. They all, you know, I just saw, okay, that is what the memoir industry is looking for. They're not really bothered about...
There's definitely a PowerPoint deck somewhere with exactly that.
they all seem to be, that's the thing, that's the story. Right. And people had asked me to do a memoir, so that's why I thought, okay, I'm going to break this down. I'm soon going to be 70. At the time, I'm soon going to be 71. So the 70, nearly up. I should put it out there that people... could have a year of my life, 1,000 words, and they write about that year. And they don't get to choose which year. If they want to do this, they email me in. I put their names in a hat, pull out their name. So the first one that comes out is for my first year. Actually, I did gestation. So they get the 9 months of that.
Did they only get 900 words? Or
did they only get 900? They were allowed 1,000 as well. But the response to this was a lot bigger than I thought. So I thought, okay, I will have the dark subconscious, no, the subconscious as well. So somebody could write about the above life, somebody else could write about the subconscious life of the 10-year-old Bill Drummond. And they could look up on Google or completely make anything up they wanted to. So it could be, so it was going to be, the analogy is like a patchwork quilt. You know, nothing needed to tie together.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what it was going to be like. They weren't going to be paid to do it. They were going to get a certificate, or the above people get a certificate of ownership of that year in my life. But it was quite clear, you don't own the things I owned in that year. It's kind of, I don't want to use the word conceptual, but whatever, you know. And then the under ones, I took a bunch of stones from a beach in Suffolk, Flintstones, went up to this loch near where I come from in Galloway and threw stones in the loch and then caught in a little glass vial. I'd caught a ripple in that and then sent them, they got a ripple.
But I was intrigued by that because I heard the spoken. It ended with you in the car, unsure whether to go back and get the correct get the stones because you'd forgotten the
Yeah. The first time I did it, I went up with a shield thing and just filled it all up and then came back and thought, oh no, I told them I was going to catch ripples. So I had to go all the way back and do it again and catch the ripples.
But yeah, you did go back.
Yeah, for catch 71 ripples and sent those out. And then there was other ones. There was more than that. I thought, well, so some people could do troubled dreams. So there's about 20 troubled dreams in it. And originally, I was going to publish it as a book. And then things got more complicated in my head. I started, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this on your podcast and to you, but something about physical books and bookshops, book festivals, I started to, there's this growing negativity in me. And I don't really know, you know, it's not justified. I thought, no, I just want to do this as what I call a spoken novel. Not a spoken word, not audible. So I narrate the above things. Colleague of a friend of mine, an actor called Tam Dean Byrne, he does the under. And an actor called Angie Darcy does the troubled dreams. And they're going up one day at a time. So you can, so like now, they start going up in sometime in January. I think today's one, I was 53. Tomorrow's one, I'm 54. They're about 10 minutes a day.
And the fact that they're not bingeable, as you sort of put it,
yeah,
and they have to be listened to in that sequence, did that come quite late on? I mean, you've decided that you're kind of done with all the kind of book industry. Did you initially just think that you put it up so that people could just click through it and then thought, well, it's better to make them take this out?
Was there a point where you thought that they were going to just be put together in a book, it would be published, and did that change as you got the text back?
I'd already had growing issues with the book festivals, which is me being totally, you know.
I don't think you'll be offending or upsetting us if you have complex feelings about the book industry, so don't worry about that.
It was a gradual thing. It was a gradual shift. Yes, I wanted the book. I knew what the cover was going to look like. I knew exactly how I wanted it all to be. But something shifted. And I knew, and one of the things that was holding me back is I knew a lot of the people that had written 1,000 words were going to be very disappointed that they couldn't have go into a shop and say, hey, look, you know, there I asked about, you know, and pay, you know, that it's going to be this thing that you can hear. But I knew straight away if I was going to do that, I wanted it just bit at a time. So you couldn't binge it. Because I have a tendency to binge, you know, or, you know, hey, that's the modern world. That's the way we consume things.
Yeah.
So I was fighting that in myself.
I assume you've automated it to some degree, or do you have?
Oh yeah, it is automated, yeah. and I've never listened back. When I recorded it, I never listened back to them, and I've never heard what Tam had done or Angie had done until the day I'm hearing it.
Yeah.
So it had all been put together, yes, before it. So it was all programmed to go out a day at a time, and it is programmed that. So when it gets to 70, it starts at the beginning again.
Yeah.
But, and this is the first, I'm not saying, hey, this is, I'm not trying to sell this to you, but there's a thing that's going through my head at the moment that I kind of like the idea that every time it goes through the whole cycle, a random one of the things goes missing. And over a period of time, it's all gone. And in that sense, you know, everything's always all gone after, you know, Shakespeare and the Bible will be gone one day or whatever, you know. And I kind of like that being built into it. But I have a counter thing to that where it actually, each time it goes through, okay, I'm going to have to backtrack. There was a few people that wanted their name in the hat. The name was pulled out. They got sent, okay, this is your year. And I never heard back from them. And so there's some blank pages in it.
Oh, they wasn't reallocated to someone else.
Well, I didn't reallocate them. But then some people, oh, can I write that missing one? You know, once it's there. And then I started thinking, maybe each time it goes round, one gets left out and a new one goes in. It's so changes over time. But I also realise that one of the things that works for me about the whole thing is nobody knew what anybody else was writing. Mm-hmm. But now they would hear what other people have written.
Did you know at all? I mean, was there, once you'd sort of sent out the year, was there any interaction with people? Did anyone get in touch and say, give me some clues? What were you doing?
No.
No.
Not at all.
And when you got the 1,000 words back, was there any editing or any kind of...
Yes, there was. But not huge. You know, it is more... If a sentence seemed a bit lumpy, I'd maybe take out a lump. If there was something there in a sentence that I felt, not compromise me, but compromise maybe other people.
Because I guess some of the people writing did actually know what
yes,
you were doing.
Some people, had,
So they could, people could put in revealing things or things that you wouldn't choose to put in.
Yep, it touches on a lot of things that are to do with my real life, but in different ways, in strange ways. But one of my, not inner demon, it's not an inner demon, but one of my various inner selves goes by the name of Scissor Man, which comes from when I was a child, I had the book, the German morality tale. Shock-headed Peter, if you translate it. But yeah, he is the tailor that comes in and cuts off the boy's the thumb for biting his nails. Yeah, and so those pair of scissors have been a big thing in my head. So Scissor Man is this person that comes in and threatens to cut your balls off or cut whatever off. So Scissor Man has edited, and when it is that, whoever's narrating, if it's me or if it's Tam or if it's Angie, they put in the word Scissor Man. And on it, you can also read the words on the website each day. And if Scissor Man's edited, Scissor Man has a tag, which is, you know, a crudely drawn pair of scissors, caricature, and that's in there. So that's an editorial thing. The other thing I changed, and this is going back to childhood. So where I came from in Scotland, we would still call policemen peelers. So any mention of policemen throughout the whole book, they're referred to as a peeler. And any mention of piss is said pish, as in P-I-S-H. But I think those are the only two words that have actually shifted, changed into something. So there's some sort of a continuity through the whole thing with that.
Begin at the beginning. I write my name on the first page. I write my name, and then I write the title. Then I write my name. Then I turn over and I write the title of the book. I write chapter one, and then I write R. And when it's, I leave a space so I can make alterations as I go along, but I don't revise it afterwards. And then it goes to the typist, and she types it, and I revise that, and that's the book. That's finished.
Did anyone take it incredibly literally if they happened to get a year of your life that was, you know, where big things happen that people are aware of your history, and then you might try to shake it up a little bit?
Yeah, some of them were... There are a few, a very few, that are dull like that. There was one that I think was AI-generated.
That's interesting. If someone chose to do that...
Yeah. And I hadn't looked at any... At that point... I hadn't even crossed my mind to look at AI-generated stuff. I just thought, this is a bit weird. What, and I thought, maybe this is this AI thing. And I never emailed the person back. I just thought, okay, that one's that. You know, that reflects the time we're in right now, or going through, or feeling threatened by, or liberated by.
Did you read them through, read them aloud when you got them to? Was that part of the editing at all? Because obviously they're ultimately becoming spoken.
Before I decided to do it as a spoken thing.
Before then, or before you decided to sort of invoke Scissor Man and edit or change anything? Or you know, were some of the sentences you thought, oh, I need to change that, it doesn't roll off the tongue properly? Or...
Yeah, I did slightly. And I had somebody, this is when I was still thinking it was going to be physical book, proofread. So I had it proofread. And I have a tendency to break up paragraphs. We all do in the modern world, a lot more than people used to. So I would break up paragraphs quite a bit, and sometimes I'd give one word by itself.
Yeah.
With an ellipsis after it, and then go into whatever.
With your own writing that you've written, which seems
to be... Who's to say that's not my own writing? Just because other people have written it.
As I started saying that, I wasn't quite sure the best way to phrase it. If you put pen to paper and then you come back to it, do you naturally read it aloud to and edit it? Is that part of the process? Or once you've kind of written it, it's on paper, that's kind of done with it? If that makes sense.
I found it harder, not hugely harder, but I found it harder to read aloud what other people had written than when I'm writing when I read my own stuff. It's all my own stuff, but yeah, conceptually it's all my own stuff. Yeah, I find it a lot easier to, the rhythm of my own things fits the rhythm of...
I think I always find, reading to my five-year-old, I find that sometimes it'll be it's written for kids, but I have to get my brain around the sort of rhythm of it. Yeah. Whereas when it's your own thing, because it's gone through your internal processes. Are there some that you've just, you completely stumbled because of how they're written, the sort of the syntax of it and stuff that you found you really need to work your way through?
Well, I learned when I did it, when I recorded it all, I learned to deal with that, You just learn to space it and...
You knew what you were signing up for, I guess.
Well, I didn't know I was signing up to do them as a spoken word to begin with.
And do you feel that that's... you've got all the pieces recorded now. Do you feel that as a form it's something that you want to continue to pursue? Or do you feel like as a project you've done that, it was interesting in itself and it's not?
Yeah, I think that it's a one-off. I mean, it reflects some of other things that I've done over the years where I invite people to take part in what I'm doing. I led this choir called the 17 for 10 years, and that involved bringing people in to put scores together and formed by the choir. So that's part of how I've worked in the past. But I can't see that I would set out to write another book in this way. It was all part of my kicking back against the whole memoir thing. That's where it came from, very much so.
Is it 45? Would you consider that a memoir as well? Because that was also formally very different to a... So what you were probably being offered publishing deals to write at the time, I would imagine.
45, I set out... it's a long time ago. I set out just to spend that year writing. Mm-hmm. And whatever came out, came out. I didn't set out to write a memoir. And I don't... At that point, the publishing industry hadn't really focused in on, there's this market here for aging blokes to buy books about bands they were into when they were young. That hadn't really evolved in the same way as it did later on.
Yeah.
And I wasn't aware of a format. So I wasn't thinking, okay, I'm going to write my life story. That wasn't that. It was just different things at different times through a year in my life.
Mm-hmm. Is that a separate in your head? Because I imagine, the artist residency you're talking about, you have to put words on paper to send out to other artists, describe what's going on, but it's more kind of procedural. Is writing in a way different from sending out emails and organising people to arrive at 3 p.m. or whatever? Do you see any distinction, or is it all part of writing and getting concepts out of the head? And
it all crosses into the same thing. Yeah, I know as an outsider, so somebody comes along and they're aware, this person's had some success in music, so they're a musician. Oh, they think they're a writer now. I've never really seen inside my head, I don't see the difference. So each year, say the example, the Curfew Tower, this artist's residency, so it works as a writer's residency as well. It started off as a physical writer's... I'm going to tell you how it started, okay? Wrote a book with a colleague, and it was called Bad Wisdom, and it was about a journey to the North Pole to place an icon in the... in the Greek Orthodox version of Christianity, so like, you know, a painting of a saint. So we had a friend do a painting of Elvis. We were going to take it to the North Pole, and we were going to let it leak out love, peace and happiness down the longitudes and latitudes. And yes, there was irony in this as well. But we went off to Heathrow thinking we could get, you know, without thinking... but thinking, okay, let's go to Heathrow and get a plane to the North Pole. Next flight to the North Pole, obviously.
That's you do.
And the nearest airport to the North Pole was Helsinki. Maybe there's a nearer one, but that's on that particular day. So we went to Helsinki. And then we got a train to the most northerly station in Finland. And I can't remember the name of the town now. And then hired a car and... to drive up through the rest of Finland into, there's a bit of Norway, goes across the top, and then thinking we were going to hit the Arctic Ocean and we were going to drive over... This is midlife crisis time, by the way. I was turning 40 or 41 or something, OK? And drive across the frozen Arctic Ocean until we got to... And when we got to the top of Norway, there was no... It was November, so it was Arctic. It was night all the time up there. And the sea wasn't frozen. But then a ferry comes into this harbour where we've driven down to. And there's no... Was there a village? I can't remember. I just remember a ferry coming in, back of the ferry opening up, and we drove onto the ferry, this light. And we hadn't bought a ticket, but, you know, you paid for a ticket. And it took us to this little island called Nordkap. And we went into... had a little village in it, had one hotel. We checked into the hotel. We went down to the bar, and we... overheard these guys, or we got talking to these three blokes, and one of them was the lighthouse keeper for the most northerly lighthouse in the world, which is somewhere off in the Arctic Ocean. And we thought, okay, this is meant to be. We give him the icon of Elvis to hang in the galley, is that the right word? Kitchen? In a, yeah, I think, yeah. And that the love, peace and happiness would go up the lighthouse and then be spread out, you know. So that's what we did. Then we wrote this whole thing up. And I'd just read one of those books that sells 60 million copies. What was it called? About monks in Italy in the medieval times, travelling hundreds of miles to read a book. I can't remember what the title of this book was. But that somehow got to me, and we just decided that we should just make one copy of our book and we should have it somewhere that people had to travel to read. Then my colleague, Mark Manning, he saw an advert in The Independent on Sunday, and it had this tower, and it had a price, £80,000. And I just thought, wow, look at this tower. It didn't say where it was, just a phone number. Phoned up on the Monday. It's in Northern Ireland. And I've got an ongoing relationship with Northern Ireland. I like to think it's a kind of fault line on the human soul. And thought, that's brilliant. This tower there in Northern Ireland. And we had this big book made up. And we discovered, books fall to... Only a modern book only lasts 80 years. The paper just falls to bits. Okay. So we had this book made with paper that would last hundreds of years, or so we were told. Put it, and we'd write our book, which we'd written in our notebooks, into this big book and leave it in the tower.
So you'd write it longhand?
We'd write it longhand in the big book.
Yeah.
And then people would have to travel to the tower. But, and this is the major but, Penguin got wind of this thing and came along with the 30 pieces of silver. And our vanities were also stroked. Hey, Penguin, you know, it's like, this is validation. So I'd already bought the tower then. I'd got the big book, and which no words got written on, and Penguin did the thing, and it was shit. You know, the whole process was so... I hated every aspect of it.
Did they come in? So you had the book written, and they came in and said, "Oh, we want to publish it like this," and then started.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to change things and.
Well, no, it's not. It wasn't so much the editorial process. It was the fact that you're a couple of popular musicians. We can sell a load off the back of this. That's how, and they couldn't. The fact that I'm not doing any interviews. But that's the whole point. And so it just, it didn't work as a...
Yeah, I mean, it's almost...
And then our editor left. Anyway, the one person who's vaguely got it left during the process of it coming out. So I was left with this tower.
Did you get the durable book?
Oh, yeah. The cover is made from reindeer hide from a ship coming from Sweden that was going to Italy, and for some reason wasn't going down the English Channel, went round Cornwall, so it must have, I don't know, it sunk there, and these hides were discovered the year we were doing this, and it was a boat from 17 something that had sunk, so these hides had survived, so it's covered in these hides, and as I said, the paper was handmade paper. I mean, so it's about that thick by about that size. So we've got this tower, we've got this big book, and then I've got a young family, everything changes. So what do I do with this place? Nobody would want to buy it. There is no market for this.
You said it's a tower.
Okay.
What is it, a tower?
It's called the Curfew Tower. Mm-hmm. It's in the middle of this little village called Cushendall on the Antrim coast of Northern Ireland. And it was built by this guy called Turnley, who had this vision of some future world of what it should be like. So he created this idealistic town that he thought was going to...
Right.
And this tower was built at the centre of it. So it was after the Napoleonic Wars, but if you were to see a picture of the tower, it feigns looking medieval. Mm-hmm. It has battlements around the top. It's got five floors, a room on each floor.
It's in the middle of this.
And it's right at the crossroads at the middle of this village.
As a sort of panopticon or as a faux defensive... position or something. I'm trying to think what the guy's sort of planning when he's...
It wasn't like a dwelling. It was...
Somebody had come back from the Napoleonic Wars. He had to live in there, and he had to... It's got a cell, prison cell on the ground floor. Anybody that's out after the curfew time gets locked up. That's why it's called the curfew tower. And as I'm left, I've bought this tower, and you can't sell it because nobody there would want to live in this place. It doesn't, even though it's like the symbol of the village, it's on the school bat, school blazer, it's there everywhere. You can't rent it out, because if you rent it out, you have to have fire escape down the side. You can't put a fire escape down the side because it's a listed building. So I thought, I'll turn it into an artist residency, and then artists stay here, but they have to leave a piece of art behind. Mm-hmm. That's why it started. And it sort of evolved. And each year I have a different setup curating the year. And it has evolved in different ways. So there's different places from around the world that you will curate a year. Sometimes it is local to Northern Ireland, so like the Seamus Heaney Centre, which is the creative writing department at Queen's University in Belfast, they curated a year, so it was a poetry year. It works in different ways.
Yeah, and is anything happening to the massive ancient book?
Okay, what happened was it was just left sitting there in the kitchen. An artist started writing in it.
Right.
And it got filled up, without any explanation. So now I thought it should stay there, but, the people within the Northern Irish cultural setup said, you can't just leave this here. This is a thing of cultural value. This documents a whole something. So it's locked up somewhere in Belfast. Uh-huh. So it can't be stolen or burnt or...
The cast iron confidence of the first person who opened it with like a blank page went, I know what I'm going to do. Fair play. Yeah, nice. So it has become something that you would have to travel somewhere to look at.
Absolutely.
Which is not the curfew time. That's fitting.
It's quite a switch as well to go from a book that's designed to last hundreds of years to a book that's designed to sort of delete itself or possibly delete itself. It doesn't even exist as a book in a physical form.
You've talked about your possibly well-placed antipathy towards very strong sort of plot-based novel, the traditional novel, as it were. Uh-huh. As someone who's written a manual about how to write a number one record, and I'm sure it arguably you might suggest that it was a specific time that might have applied to, but people seem to use that. Do you think that there's anything that you could use in the same way to write a best-selling novel? Is it comparable to a record in that sense? And I'm not asking that for tips to write a novel, but I'm just interested in whether it's a thing that's transferable across art forms.
I've never set out to write a best-selling novel. I've never written a best-selling novel.
Yeah.
I mean, we can all see, you know, you go into, you see a film, something happens in the first 5 minutes, that then think, okay, I've got to see how this resolves, so I'll give over the next 90 minutes of my life to see how it resolves. And I guess all traditional novels have to have something similar that commits you to giving that time of your life up.
Yeah.
But that's not how to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this quite a lot there, about how this sort of primary storytelling mode now being film. And I always think that if you're reading or writing, I think, just strongly plot-based novels that don't have much else going on around it, you're kind of wasting what the novel can do in terms of the interiority of it and sort of, you know, you can get inside someone's head much more than I think you can in sort of film.
Yeah, of course you can. I mean, and that's why, even though I'm saying I'm involved in two films and I want to get those done, I mean, the written word has always been, actually, it's the play. I think plays are a bigger thing for me than novels in my life and films and music.
You mean in terms of theatre?
Yeah, I think.
In terms of, is that something you write, or in terms of going to see plays is more important?
It's both. It's both. I mean, I worked in theatre. Firstly, in the carpentry workshop, building and painting stage sets, and then designing stage sets. So working with playwrights. And this was in my early 20s. So some of those playwrights I was working with then had a big influence on me. So I knew playwrights before I ever knew authors of novels. Mm. And just that process of writing a thing and then making it work in a room. And it was always, even from the beginning, so this would be 1974, maybe 73, 74, it would be studio theatre, so intimate.
I mean, I imagine it's quite connected to this sort of conceptual writing, conceptual art, when you're in that small sort of theatre.
Yeah.
It's not lavish sets that are doing the work, it's the concept.
Yeah.
Somebody holding a block of wood, that's all you need. You don't have the huge production behind it.
I mean, I've worked on, you know, at that time in my life, I would work on big productions, but I knew it was always the far more intimate things. I've never liked wow factor. I've always been responded negatively to anything that relies on wow. Even though I've been guilty of it at times myself.
Do you see music and art and writing within that same conceptual approach? When you sort of were working in music, were you approaching things, was that different in any way? Or
not really, no. I'm afraid it was always, I mean, this sounds pretentious, but I think it was really always from a conceptual point of view.
Yeah, that comes across. It doesn't feel a huge disjunct between what you were doing musically and what you were doing in writing or in art. But yeah, I was just curious if you sort of thought, oh, that was when I was doing music, it was in a different sort of space mentally or something.
So the third of the triptych of novels by William E. Drummond, the first being The Life Model, the second one being The Elderly Gentleman, which is just a series of letters and that were written in 2022. And they go out up onto my site, the Penkelmburn site, each day, date of the year that they were originally written. But the third part of this triptych of novels starts going out tomorrow. And it's called Tenzing Scott Brown. And he's one of my internal people who's a playwright. So these are all plays. They are being performed, read out, performed by the two actors I'm already working with. So they do all the parts. And that starts tomorrow.
And you, obviously it's all your writing, but you have written these plays.
Yeah, or my inner Tenzing Scott Brown, who's now dead, by the way. They were all written between 2016 and the end of 2021, I think. But I knew, even while I was writing them, they were some can be performed. Well, a lot, you know, they could be put on stage, and some have been put on stage, I've done them. But they kind of more exist as a thing to listen to, I think.
And will they be sort of disappearing as well in the same sort of way? Or?
They are only, one goes up, or one chapter goes up every Wednesday.
Right.
As a teenager in the 60s, or in the second half of the 60s, there was a thing called the Wednesday Play on BBC One. And I used to love this thing called the Wednesday Play. I'd never know what it was going to be until it was on. It was on. Each one only lasted about an hour. And they took all sorts of risks, or it seemed to me at the time, about what they were going to be doing, how they were going to work. And that had a huge influence on me, an ongoing influence. Mm-hmm. So I like the idea that these plays, they go up on a Wednesday for 24 hours. So as of midnight tonight, the first lot goes up.
Right.
And it's only there for those 24 hours. I am slightly compromising. So next Wednesday, a week tomorrow, the new one will go up, but you'll also be able to read the one from the previous week.
Mm-hmm. Are they connected, or is it just to sort of keep the theme?
Not really. They're not really. I mean, they're connected in... It's what's ever in... They reflect stuff that's going on in my head at that particular time. So the first of them is actually called Bill Drummond is Dead, and it's not really a play, but it's just exploring the ideas of... And then they evolve. So to go back to the Curfew Tower, every year... I'm not leaving the plays behind, but... every year... In the Wednesday of the first full week of August, we have an event where we celebrate the work that had been done by artists or writers or whatever had been staying in the tower the previous year, you know, from 1st of January to the 31st of December. We put on an exhibition, or we have, and we make a big vat of curry, and we have a bonfire in the back garden. So one of the plays is discussion or debate between the tower and the fire. So I've allowed myself to get, you know, so obviously you could never put a play that is a discussion between a fire and a tower on stage.
Some logistical challenges anyway. Do you have a sort of clear idea of the ultimate form when you get, like when an idea comes to you for that, say the tower and the fire, it could be a play, it could be just something written as written word, it could be a conceptual art piece that doesn't involve any words being written down or any actors acting anything. Or do you have an idea? Okay, this is the idea, and it's going to be something in roughly that space. It's going to be a play, probably. Or does that kind of evolve as the words come down? You think, oh wait a minute, this is not a part of a novel I'm writing. It's a short play, or this is going to be something completely different.
Very much. It was I, for that period in my life, so 2016 to the end of 2021, everything was a play. Everything I was writing was a play. And I also felt, I think it was a response the fact that we could now photograph everything, for the people listening, I'm holding my phone just now. You know, people were taking a photograph of every meal they ate and putting it up on Instagram. So documentation was everywhere all the time. And I was kind of thinking, I don't want to use photography to document what's going on in my head or what I'm physically doing. I wanted to write plays about it, to explore it from another angle, to document.
Still documenting it, but using a different
form. And that really freed something up. So it's not me either taking a photograph of it or painting a painting of it or just writing a piece about it, but evolving it into a play.
Have you sort of found you go through phases of, 2016 to 2021, writing plays, 2010 to 2016, you were doing something else? Or I imagine you've got quite a lot of irons and a lot of different fires at the same time.
See, in my head, it's all the same fire. And it's not an iron, it's my hand that's in the flames. And it's only when it comes out that whatever it is I'm exploring, it takes a form or out. And yes, for that period,
they were all coming out as plays.
It was coming out as plays. And I think, I'm not saying I was burnt out or my hand was burnt, but I did feel, no, I've got to draw a line here. I wanted to draw a line. And there was that part of me that thought, even then, and this is a novel. And the novel is called Tenzing Scott Brown. And he is the main character who thinks he's a playwright and is writing these plays that can never be performed.
Well, thank you very much to Bill for coming and joining us on a pretty rainy day earlier this year.
And thank you for listening. You can find out more about the podcast and other past guests and listen through to our back catalogue at unsoundmethods.co.uk or find us on Twitter at unsoundmethods.
We'll put a load of stuff in the show notes about Bill's current projects. The Penkiln Burn, which is the memoir sort of spoken novel, which can't be binged. So that's the one that we talked about in the episode. So you have to go and log on and find out what episode is on today. And there's new strands of that that has started that he mentioned that have just kicked off. So go and get that while it's fresh.
I also should add, depending when you're listening to this, it may have deleted itself. As we alluded to in the conversation, it may have deleted itself. So do log on and check it out before it disappears.
You can find out about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com or at jamiebatchin on X, Twitter, whatever it is called next, or at jamie_batchin on Instagram.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or rather less often these days on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
Aren't we all? It's no place for a human being.
No.
Anyway, enjoy your lives. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.